late 1970s, Formica and the Bitches, Portland's first all-girl punk band, played a few shows in Portland and Seattle, and then broke up. Out of its ashes, two teenage sisters who were in the band, Kim and Katie Kincaid, recruited Pat Baum, another young woman in the early Portland punk scene, to play drums for a new band, the Neo Boys.
For 4 years, the Neo Boys played shows, mostly in Portland and mostly as an opening act. They left behind two great records, a 7-inch recorded in 1980 on Greg Sage's Trap Records, and a self-released LP in 1982.
Though they had their own distinctive sound, you can definitely hear the New York influence, television spareness, and a dedication to lyrics like Patti Smith or Richard Hell. With the addition of permanent guitarist Meg Henches, the band sound gelled, turning into a driving melodic punk with a bit of Western twang.
The Neo Boys should be remembered, alongside the Rats and the Wipers, as one of Portland's great first-wave punk bands. Introduce yourselves and say what you did in the Neo Boys and how you would describe yourself now.
I'm Kim Kincaid, and I sang with the Neo Boys, and now I do garden design and estate gardening.
I'm Pat Baum, and I was the drummer with the Neo Boys, and now I'm an environmental activist, and I live in Mexico. I work with endangered sea turtles.
Quick, long, hiding shadows. Exit, come and escape from light. Break through, smash, there's a feature as a dad. Smile to the paper, lick my ass, go down in shape. Running in the shadows. Rolling in the gutter. Running in the shadows. No for the savage looking through the streets. Night dance, holding tight pie. Control only choke down on it, please. When you're losing part of the die. Running in the shadows. Running in the gutter. Running in the shadows. Don't shed back up and you can try to key. Check the rules. Death zone, jail door, one down, a million to go. Running in the shadows. Running in the gutter. Running in the shadows. Quick, run, hide in shadows. Exit, come and escape from light. Break through, smash, cause I'll beat you to a pulp. Smile to the stable, let my ass go down in shape. Running in the shadows. Running in the gutter. Running in the shadows.
I never really felt like it was that premeditated. It just kind of happened. We wanted to play music, and it was a good creative outlet, and, you know, hooked up with the group and just went from there.
I always wanted to play drums, but they would never let me, like, in school, because they said girls can't play drums. And because I played the clarinet, that kind of, you know, pigeonholed me into the clarinet. But my brother and I used to jam because he played the piano, and I just had like some bongos with drumsticks and I think maybe a pie plate cymbal or a pan lid cymbal. But when I moved into a house that had a drum set, then I started playing it secretly, like when nobody was home. And then when Christy and Andrea went to London, then you guys got me into the band.
I mean, I felt like it was more like getting together and playing and expressing and being creative, and not a whole lot of emphasis on, you know, learning your craft before you get out there and do that. I think that that was kind of a retaliation against what was going on with music at the time.
And also, I think the lyrics carried a lot of that. So you could just have this noise behind you, not us, obviously, but, you know, the lyrics really could help the, you know, if the musicians weren't so great, if the lyrics were really strong, you know, most of the bands had really good lyrics. So, because, I mean, it was almost like instant. You would almost have the show and then form the band to play the show or something like that. I think one of the early ones was television, wasn't it? And we just weren't really good, and we were really nervous.
Was it a big show?
Yeah, it was a big show opening for television.
Uh-huh. I remember we had to have at least 20 minutes, and we didn't have very many songs. And so we played this one song that was called Sooner or Later, and those were the only lyrics in the song, and we played that for like 7 minutes. Remember?
Uh-huh. And I think television was kind of like, not really laughing at us, but they were just sort of like,
what? The heck?
After that show, I think we got a lot better
really
fast.
Yeah, we did.
And we just kind of learned as we went along. And because we used to practice every day
we practiced. We took it so serious with the
learning and getting better.
I know. I can't believe we practiced every day.
And how old were you when the band started?
14.
Pat was telling a story how they used to have to sneak you out of the house or you weren't allowed to be in the band.
We couldn't put your picture on the poster.
Uh-huh. In case
your brother would find out. It's like, okay, the Neo Boys are playing a show, but Kim's not going to be there, you know, so we'd have to do all this, you know, clandestine stuff.
And then you guys were going to temporarily replace me with a guy. Remember?
I don't remember that.
Because you were grounded or something?
Yeah.
She was always grounded.
I was always grounded.
From your older siblings?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
They didn't like what you were doing.
Well, yeah, they didn't. I mean, I think that their intentions were good, but they really didn't realize how good the band really was for me in so many ways. You know, that it was a tremendous amount of discipline and dedication. And, you know, I think that they thought that the people I was hanging with were, you know, a bad influence and stuff.
And your sister was in the band.
My sister was in the band.
But you were the youngest.
Yeah, and she was 2 years older and, you know, had moved out of the house. My brother had custody of me. So I would, like, sneak out of the house to see shows or sneak out of the house to go to rehearsal. And then a friend of my brother's wife saw a show and said, you know, oh, hey, I saw Kim playing at a show. And I was in so much trouble. But then again, I think it helped them understand the importance of it.
The song's called School Rules.
Decided I couldn't be decided. Patiently I wait for that conclusion.
like, would you just sit in your room and write your lyrics? Because you had, like...
Yeah, I did.
Lots of songs. Really, yeah. Really great songs.
Yeah, yeah. And that's another thing that I don't think that they realized, you know, something like that, somebody that age, you know, that's such a great outlet for an adolescent to be able to write or just, you know, sit and do journals or write lyrics or whatever. I don't think that they realized how it was really a positive thing in many ways. Pat and Katie and I just all worked really well together. And then Jennifer was originally with us, and then it just seemed
she went to L.A.
Yeah.
After Jennifer, we had a couple guitar players that just didn't really work out. I mean, I think they were just sort of like guitar players that somebody said they were guitar players. You know,
yeah.
They weren't like really... that experience.
Yeah.
Were they always women?
Mm-hmm.
Was there an intention to keep the band all women?
I think after a time, yeah. First, it just sort of happened that way. You know, when we were looking for Meg, we definitely wanted, you know.
Yeah, because there was plenty of guys around that could have fit the bill, but it just, I think the chemistry and just the whole process was so much different with when it was all women.
So what was your songwriting process like?
The lyrics would be written without, you know, a melody or something in mind. And then often we were going through different guitar players. So the melody would often be written on the bass. And Katie would play chords on the bass as well. So it was, you know, really kind of different than the way most writing happens, I think, with musicians. So often it
but
would
I just
be singing
remember
over the music. Too.
We'd spend a lot of time at it, you know, trying to make a song.
Yeah.
I remember sitting at the drums a lot, like waiting
for
that
yeah.
process to happen
yeah.
because I wasn't really, you know, I didn't play the guitar that much back then, so I wasn't really part of the musical
yeah.
part of it. It happened pretty easily.
Yeah.
Especially when we got Meg.
Meg, yeah.
Because Meg was just incredible.
She was such a talent. You know, at that time, you know, there wasn't even a name for it. I remember being in high school and, you know, punk rock was happening, but people didn't even know it was called punk rock. They just called you a freak. You know, they hadn't had you pigeonholed yet. You really had to kind of hunt it out at that time. I remember we would pick up Rock Scene magazine. We're talking, you know, 25 years ago plus. And it was just such different times then. And so we would look at that. for the bands that we were interested in. At that time, it was Patti Smith, Television, a lot of the bands that were playing in New York at the time. And
Richard Hell.
Richard Hell and the Voidoids.
Jonathan Richman.
Yeah. And then it was also being interested in David Bowie and Iggy Pop, the New York Dolls, T-Rex.
Yeah, because I remember really kind of young. The evolution from glitter to punk.
Yeah.
It wasn't that big of a stretch. I mean, I remember those sort of like those crazy underage discos, you know?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
What was that one called that was up on 10th?
Let me think. There was the Metropolis.
Yeah.
Oh, no, it was before the Mildred's Palace.
Right. And so there was like these crazy underage places, but they didn't have live music. It was just like a disco. You could go there and you dress however you wanted. It wasn't like, you know,
downtown.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, and then we would always go to all the, you know, like if David Bowie or Iggy Pop or somebody was coming to town, that would be like the big event, you know, of the year or whatever,
yeah.
of the month. Kim and a bunch of other people lived over in Vancouver. They were all underage, and so to even like come over to Portland without a car or whatever, but there was this friend of ours named Fred who would like bring them all over, like to a show or whatever. So there was kind of this like
hitchhike.
There was this merging of the Vancouverites with the Portlandites, you know,
yeah.
and it was like we'd meet up at shows and then maybe like go to somebody's apartment afterwards.
Yeah.
And
but it was so small. It was, you know, maybe 25 people mm-hmm. plus
mm-hmm.
that were interested in, you know, alternative music. Uh-huh. Portland was so podunk, really. It was nice that it was all, you know, homespun. You know, everybody did work together, and if you did want to have a show, then you just got it together and booked a hall and had an underage venue for everybody to come. And
we used to have shows in just wherever we could have them.
Yeah.
You know?
There wasn't any clubs per se, and the bars didn't really want to book that type of music.
Well, also, we didn't want to book it into the bars because everyone was underage,
yeah.
so nobody could even come to the show. That was the so that's why we had them just in all these weird, like, Roz's rehearsal studio uh-huh. up by the Arbuckle Flat Coffee House, and then, you know, we'd rent these halls all around town, but usually there would just be one show there because something would happen. You know, either the cops would come or a big plate glass window would get broken. Or, you know,
or the Gypsy Jokers would show up. And yeah, so that was it. We blew it.
Yeah, it
we
was
couldn't
just
have
a one-time thing. We even did one at the Linton Community Center,
oh, yeah.
remember?
Oh, that was scary.
So
and at Calaroga Terrace, that was a funny one.
It was like a retirement home.
Yeah, where is that? I know
it's
that name.
Over
it's over on
Hollywood.
Widler. No, it's over like...
Is it by Lloyd Center?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
You did it in like the rec room or something?
Yeah, wow. And it was all glass and we were just freaking out
we
hoping that
behavior.
Nothing
Everybody
would happen.
Was so good. And then at Portland State,
oh, yeah,
they
right.
wouldn't let us play. We were playing with the
with
Dills.
With the Zeros?
No, the Dills. And they had like a...
Oh, yeah, that's right.
It was canceled because
yeah.
of the posters. There was like a hammer and sickle on
uh-huh.
it, and they were like, oh, no.
Yeah, and then, you know, the postering effort was really incredible because we'd just go all over town, and we'd use, like, either Elmer's glue or, like, sweetened condensed milk, and so they'd really stick. And so the posters would be up for, like, you know, those Screamers posters were up for years.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
You'd see them. It was just such a great collective effort, you know.
Yeah.
Everyone was doing everything. There was no like male-female roles,
mm-mm.
you know. There was, you know, everyone was just doing it for the good of the scene, you know. It was
yeah.
like...
And trying to create a scene because
yeah.
there wasn't one,
right.
you know. There's a place.
Place. There's a place, make me a place.
And we actually had two clubs that we rented. One was up on like 41st and Division.
Oh,
remember
yeah.
that? It was sort of in
I was grounded that whole month, so
I didn't get to go to any shows.
That's how long the club lasted.
I think it lasted a little bit longer, but not much longer, because there was always we had the stage down in the basement, but it was still way too loud for the neighborhood. So it's since been torn down. But remember the El Rigoletto building? That was that.
Clockwork Joe's?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was great. I mean, that was just such an effort on, you know, everybody's part to rent a hall.
A lot of construction, because every band had their own practice room.
And where was that?
It was on 2nd and Alder.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And it was great, because it was a really walk-up. And I remember one time, what was his name? Angie? That guy that used to do the door. He was doing the door, and the cops came, and he was, like, taking a bong hit, like, right when the cops came. And so they busted the whole show, and I don't remember what we did. But it was cool. The rehearsal spaces were great, because there was these rooms kind of on the side, and I think Stan did a lot of construction, too, to make it all happen. But so every band had their like rehearsal room, and then there was this nice hall. It was really cool.
Yeah.
It had like
an art gallery,
a stage, and it probably was maybe like a 100-person hall or something. Maybe
what was it called?
Clockwork Joe's. Yeah.
And how long did it last?
Almost a year. I don't know if it lasted that long, but there was always landlord problems. Uh-huh. I mean, you can imagine, because we really had to lie about what we were doing to make it, to even get the place. I think Sten a lot acted like the responsible party a lot of the times to like get the lease. And
but it was a collective effort. We've formed like an organization called the Alternative Arts Association.
And it was like, wasn't it a nonprofit?
Mm-hmm.
I think, yeah.
And then often the shows wouldn't make any money, so it couldn't pay for the space, but by having the art gallery and the rehearsal band spaces there, the bands had to pay rent, so that would pay for the use of the hall.
I think the rent was like $500 a month, maybe. But for us, that was a lot of money,
yeah.
You know, so I can't remember how much we paid.
Yeah.
Maybe $100 a month.
I think so, yeah. Oh, I remember living there for a while.
What year was this?
Probably like
79
or 80, yeah.
Police told me the government owes me. They'll give me a gun and a license to kill. Oh, you made me, you really can't hate me. You give me the reason, now you give me will. I've been doing till I'm the green bag again. I'll be your gorilla, you'll forget what I. The dirty work and you take the blame.
Well, we did that, the first single in my parents' living room. They were going to go away for the weekend, so we just sort of like took over their house. And remember, they came back like right when we were doing some vocal overdubs, and I think they just...
Did you tell them you were going to do
it? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And they just, and then we moved to my house, I remember.
Oh, yeah.
That's right.
Just to do the final...
The vocals.
Yeah,
when my brother was gone.
And this was 4-track back then, all of those... And I think the Wipers, you know, kind of crossed over with their first album. It was either 8 or 16, but we just had 4-track, and so that's how all of those first ones were recorded.
We'll
Greg's age too. I think the Wipers. Yeah.
Because when they really came, they were sort of like the, you know, these
first
like
real band.
Yeah, I mean, they were so together. He had had to leave Portland because there was just no live music, and so he, I don't know why he went to Florida. I don't really remember, but he came back when we had the place on Division, because I remember hearing them for the first time and just being absolutely blown away that somebody could, a band could be so good and so tight and so just raw. And I mean, they had everything, and they just looked like these regular guys, you know. They weren't punky at all, you know. I mean, Greg sort of, you know, just because his hair was kind of wild, but you know, the other two guys just kind of look like regular guys, but they were such good musicians, and I know we really looked up to them. And you know, Sam was my idol, and she still is, Sam Henry. And I know Katie really looked up to Dave as a bass player, because he was just incredible, you know. And with Greg too, what I remember is he didn't have like a big ego about who he was and what he was. It's sort of like, it took us a long time to even know that he was like a recording engineer. You know, that sort of like came out, you know, slowly. He didn't just dump it all on us, you know. And then when he was producing our first single, I'd been around some of his other recording sessions, but just when he was doing that, I mean, we just kind of realized like what an incredible talent he was, and how he was able to, you know, here we had like a weekend to do this record in, you know, but he was just so incredible, you know, as far as like how he was not a very domineering like producer, but he was just kind of trying to help us make it happen.
Most interesting shows we played was at the Oregon State Penitentiary. We opened for the Wipers, and that was just bizarre.
Wow. Yeah, it was.
It was just really wild. We were kind of billed as girls, 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 and they didn't get that.
Yeah, it was really tense.
It was just an intense experience.
Going in there, being searched, and it was really strange, because I played at the women's prison with the other all-girl band that I was in, The Twist, and that was really fun.
Yeah.
But that one at the men's, it was like this whole cafeteria full of like really hostile men yelling at us, screaming, you know, obscenities at us, and, you know, Yeah, it was. But they loved the wipers. Once the wipers started playing, everything was cool. But our set was pretty bad.
Yeah.
Blaster through it.
Oh, we were playing so fast. I think because we were so nervous, for one. I just remember we were just like flying through the set. And this, there was this fellow in the front row that was blind, and he was digging it. He loved it.
He was
it.
Dancing,
yeah.
kind of.
And then yeah. he later came and talked to us and said he really liked the show and was, you know, familiar with Patti Smith and the New York Dolls and, you know, knew some, you know, just different types of music that I think a lot of the guys in the prison, I just don't think that they could relate to us at all.
When was that?
Gosh.
It's probably like 1980 or something, 1979.
Because Meg wasn't with us.
Oh, yeah, that's
yeah,
right.
Yeah, it was with
Dawn.
Yeah, oh. yeah.
Some of the Long Goodbye shows were really good,
uh-huh.
I remember.
Yeah. We opened for Nico, and that was
yeah, that was
really,
cool.
I don't know, I felt very honored.
We played with the Wipers a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah once we kind of got hooked up uh-huh. with them,
we
that
were,
was
like,
really good.
Double
yeah.
bill, often we'd mm-hmm. yeah, play together.
WW2.
The main people that were like supporting was like Mark Stan. He was a musician, but he also had a lot of other skills, like as far as organizational mm-hmm. and carpentry. And then, of course, Tom Robinson, just for his audio skills. And all of those shows wouldn't have been recorded if it wasn't
yeah.
for him. And then Mike Lastra from Smegma, who recorded the audio, but also recorded a lot of video, so there's a lot of video from some of those early shows. And Fred Cole, too. I mean, the thing about Fred is, if it wasn't for Fred, none of the bands would have had instruments, because you could go in there and yeah. buy whatever you needed, and if you didn't have all the money, I remember making payments on things, mm-hmm. you know, maybe it was only like $10 here and there whenever I had it.
This is when he had Captain Wes Eagles.
Yeah, yeah.
Downtown.
Well, first
yeah.
it was over here on Grand, and then they moved downtown on
3rd and Washington, uh-huh. I think it was.
It was so fun to just go in there and look and see what he had and,
or he'd
you know,
something
just hang
for
out.
You, that you found in a thrift store,
uh-huh.
you know.
Were you aware of his history playing music at all?
I think I found out about it later.
Later. I didn't realize, really.
What was the name?
What was the name? The Weeds.
Oh, yeah. yeah.
And then the Lollipop Shop right. before that.
Yeah, and it's like his style didn't really change that much. It just kind of like the music just got faster, you know. But, I mean, Fred is just amazing that he's still playing. I mean,
and Tootie.
And Tootie, yeah.
They're great.
When we first started, I had this crazy job, remember, with the 4-H?
Oh, yeah.
Where I was, like, teaching kids photography and leather craft and things. It was like an urban 4-H program. It was pretty cool. But then I got a job at Park Avenue Records, and so that was pretty fun because I would just be around records all day. Then later I did sound at Euphoria, which was a pretty fun but also pretty awful job. I mean, it was good because they had a lot of national acts, but it was pretty abusive. I think I only made like $20 a night.
Did you guys live together at some point? I remember there were punk houses.
Yeah, there was. The Kearney House was on 23rd and Kearney.
Magazine X was in the Laurelhurst neighborhood.
And then there, the Smegma House over on Rodney, or wherever it was. Remember the Brooklyn Street House?
Oh, yeah. The Worm Room.
Where we used to practice. Yeah, practicing was always a problem.
Yeah. But we had some cool practice
spaces. We did. Remember Steve Lyons?
Yep. And then we used to practice at the train station.
We rented a little room.
One of the offices above or something?
No, it was down below by the baggage area.
Yeah. Wow.
It was a photography studio, but somehow I talked the lady into letting us rent.
Would it echo up through the hall? Or?
Probably, but we always did it at night, you know, and I remember there was no bathroom, so we'd always be, like, peeing in cups and stuff like that. But
at what point did you, I mean, you guys, coming from the really small scene, like, at what point did you kind of realize that you didn't know everybody in the audience anymore and that it was kind of expanding and changing? Or
I think it was for our record release party.
Yeah, that was a really fun show.
There was a lot of people there. We had a draw of, like, over 200 people at a show. I'm feeling pretty, like, wow. I remember seeing younger people. You know, seeing
again,
which was great. I remember there's this little entourage of young girls that used to come to all our shows. It was great. You know, it was just really nice to see that, you know, maybe you were influencing or making an impact on some people. I guess that's when I really noticed it, when I started seeing, you know, a lot of younger people, a whole new generation coming to the shows.
How old were the younger people and how old were you at that point?
I guess I was like 17 at the time, and you know, seeing
14 year olds.
So how long was the lifespan of the band, and why did you guys break up?
How long did we play? Like 4 years or 5 years?
Yeah, four years. Well, I think Meg left, and that sort of, we just didn't really think that we could find anyone.
I think part of it was just so much, it was a lot of hard work. We kind of lost the momentum.
Yeah, I mean, I still really wanted to play, and I really wanted to play with women. So, I mean, I just kind of kept doing whatever I could.
Yeah.
And I tried to get another all-girl thing going with Leslie and Marlis, but it didn't pan out. Marlis moved away, and I played with Rancid Vat, and then I played, with The Grip for a while and with The Twist, mm-hmm. and then later with The Unknown Soldiers. But I think I was getting also interested in just engineering, and, you know, I had my show on KABU, and I really liked that.
I played, sang with a couple of bands afterwards, but nothing too serious, just sat in with a couple of, didn't form a band or anything like that. Always kind of felt like it was with the Neo Boys, you know, it wasn't something that, I don't look at myself as a musician or a songwriter, singer-songwriter, anything like that. I think it happened that I played with the Neo Boys, and that chapter had closed. Just went on to do other things.
Like what?
Well, I became involved in horticulture, and just that's been my passion ever since. Just been doing that for 20 years.
I got interested in doing sound and on films. I worked on Gus Van Sant's first film.
Uh-huh.
Maybe not first, but his first feature. Uh-huh. And then I started making my own films. I haven't really done any film stuff for like 10 years because I've been in Mexico, but I'm working on a film about MLC because I went there in the early 70s. And then I'm working on a documentary about the leatherback turtle, too. I started working with trying to save endangered sea turtles down in Baja because I was living on the beach and would just see a lot of really destructive, like, human impact things. So I kind of started this one-woman campaign to try to get cars off the beach, and I've been pretty successful. Now we actually have a turtle group that's made up of all people from the community, so we're a lot more powerful than just me out there yelling at people, trying to get people aware of how damaging plastic garbage is to the ocean. It's really sad. There's so much plastic in the ocean. Yeah. I'm constantly pulling plastic bags out, and that's just the ones that are floating near the surf. Yeah, it's really sad. Plastic is going to be the death of us all, I think. Live by vinyl, die by vinyl. Thank you.
This interview was conducted by Aaron Yankee and Icky A. at KBOO in the summer of 2004.
Thanks to Pat Baum, Kim Kincaid, and Vanessa Renwick.
The songs played come from the 102979 compilation, the Neo Boys 7-inch and LP, and from a live performance recorded at KBOO in April of 1980.
Keep listening to KBOO. Support KBOO.
Yeah.
KBOO is definitely a light at the end of the tunnel. One of the only lights.